Zuga called the little Matabele maiden from the fireside where she knelt beside Robin, helping her to treat one of the porters who had been struck by a flying splinter of rock during the attack, and whose shoulder had been laid open to the bone. "Juba," he told her, "I want you to come with me." And the girl glanced back at Robin, hesitating to obey him. Zuga's irritation flared again. He and Robin had not spoken again since Zuga had broken up the attack with rifle fire, and Yun Shirut had reassembled the caravan and led it out of the deadly trap of the gorge to where it was camped now in the foothills beyond the pass. "Come," Zuga repeated, and the child dropped her eyes at his tone and followed him submissively as he started back towards the pass. Zuga moved back cautiously, pausing every 50 paces or so to survey the cliff tops suspiciously, although he was fairly certain that there would be no renewal of the boulder rolling. However, he kept in close under the sheer rock face so that any boulder would fall beyond them. The going was difficult over the loose scree, and through the thick scrub that covered it. It took them nearly an hour to get back to the spot where Zuga had marked the fall of the body of the warrior in the lion headdress, and then they had to search for nearly as long again before they found the corpse. He had fallen into a deep crevice between two rocks, and he lay at the bottom of it, on his back. The body appeared unmarked, except for the small black bullet hole low on the left side of his naked chest. The eyes were still wide open, but he had lost his headdress. After a moment, Zuga turned to Juba inquiringly. "Who is he? Of what tribe is he?" he asked. And the child showed no concern at the presence of violent death. She had seen very much worse in her short life. "Mashona," she told Zuga scornfully. Juba was Matabele, of Zanzi blood, and there was no more noble breeding outside the kraal of King Mzilikatsi himself. She felt nothing but contempt for all the other tribes of Africa, especially for these people. "Mashona," she repeated, "eaters of debt." It was the ultimate term of denigration that the Matabele applied to all the tribes that they have taken into slavery or driven to the very point of extinction.
"It is always the way these baboons fight,"
she indicated the dead man with a toss of her pretty head.
"They stand on the hilltops and throw down the stones."
Her dark eyes sparkled.
"It becomes more difficult each year for our young men to blood their spears, and until they do so, the king will not give them leave to marry."
She broke off, and Zuga smiled ironically. The child's resentment was clearly not so much at the Mashona's alleged lack of sportsmanship, but at the havoc that this wrought on the Matabele marriage markets. Zuga scrambled down into the rocky crevice and stooped over the dead warrior. Despite Juba's contempt, the man was well-formed, with straight, strong limbs and handsome, intelligent features. For the first time, Zuga felt a twinge of regret at having fired the ball which had caused that innocuous-looking little wound. It was a good thing that the warrior lay upon his back, for the exit would have been ghastly. A soldier should never examine the bodies of the men he kills in the heat of battle. Zuga had made that discovery long ago in India, for afterwards there was always this moment of guilt and remorse. He shrugged it away, for he had not come either to gloat over the kill or to torture himself with it, but to merely identify his enemy. Why had these warriors attacked the caravan without warning, he wondered? Were they the border guards of the fabled Monomotapa? It seemed the most likely explanation, though of course they could be ordinary bandits, like the dacoits of India, with whom he had made bitter acquaintance. Zuga stared moodily down at the corpse. Who had he been? And how much danger did his tribe still present to Zuga's caravan? But there was nothing more to learn, and Zuga began to straighten up again when he noticed the necklace around the corpse's throat. He knelt again to examine it. It was made of cheap trade beads on a thong of gut, a gaudy little trifle, except for the pendant that had hung on to his chest, but had slipped back under the armpit, half concealed, so that Zuga noticed it for the first time. He pulled it free, examined it a moment, and then slipped the entire necklace off over the man's head. When he put his hand around the back of the dead man's head to lift it, he felt the pieces of skull grate together deep in his head, like shards of broken pottery under his fingers. He lowered the shattered head and stood up with the necklace twined about his fingers, examining the pendant. It had been carved from ivory that had yellowed with age, and tiny black cracks formed a fine web across its polished surfaces. Zuger held it to catch the sunlight and turned it between his fingers to study it from every angle. He had seen another figurine that was almost a twin to this one, a golden figurine that was now in a bank vault in Cape Town, where he had deposited it before they had sailed on board the gunboat Black Joke. This was the same stylized bird-like shape, perched on a round plinth. The plinth was decorated with the same triangular shark's teeth pattern, and the bird had the same swelling chest and short, sharply pointed wings folded across its back. It could have been a pigeon or a dove, except for one detail. The beak was the curved and hooked weapon of a raptor. It was a falcon. He knew it beyond any doubt, and it was certain that the heraldic bird had some deep significance. The golden necklace that Tom Harkness had left him must have belonged to a king or a queen or a high priest. The choice of material, gold, was an indication of that. Now here was the same shape, worn by a man who seemed to be a chieftain, and once again the shape was faithfully copied in a precious material, ivory. The falcon of Monomotapa, Zuger wondered, studying the ancient pendant. Ancient it must be, for the ivory had acquired a deep patina and lustre. Zuger looked up at the little Matabele girl, standing almost naked above him, and watching him with interest. "Do you see this?" he asked. "It is a bird." "Have you seen it before?" Juba shook her head, and her fat little breasts joggled at the movement. "It is a Mashona thing," and she shrugged. "What would a daughter of the sons of Sensang Gakona and Chaka want with such a nonsense?" On an impulse, Zuger lifted the necklace and dropped it over his own head, letting the ivory falcon fall inside the V of his flannel shirt, where it nested against the darkly springing curls of his body hair. "Come," he told Juba. "There's nothing more for us here." And he led the way back towards the camp beyond the pass. The land into which the old bull had led them by the secret road through the pass was an elephant kingdom. Perhaps the pressure of the hunters moving up from the far southern tip of the continent had driven them into this unpeopled world. The herds were everywhere. Each day Zuger and Yan Shirut, hunting far ahead of the main caravan, came up with the huge grey pachyderms, and they shot them down. They shot and killed 48 elephant the first month, and almost 60 the second, and Zuger meticulously recorded each kill in his journal, the circumstances of the hunt, the weight of each tusk, and the exact location of the cache in which they buried them. His small band of porters could not carry even a small part of such a mass of ivory, and the distance and direction which they must still travel was uncertain. Zuger buried his treasure, always near a readily recognizable landmark, a distinctive tree or an unusual rock, a hilltop or a confluence of rivers, to enable them to find it again. He would return one day for it, and when he did, it would have dried off its excess moisture and be easier for the porters to carry. In the meantime, he spent all his daylight hours in pursuit of the quarry, walking and running great distances until his body was hard and fit as that of a highly trained athlete, and his arms and face a deep mahogany brown, even his full beard and moustache gilded to shades of gold by the bright sunlight. Every day he learned from Yan Shirut the tricks of bush lore, until he could run a difficult spoor over rocky ground without a check. He learned to anticipate the turns and the twists that the driven herds made to get below the wind and take his scent. He learned to anticipate the pattern of their movements, so that by cutting across the circuitous spoor, he could save many hours of dogged pursuit. He learned to judge the sex and size and age and ivory of a beast by the mark of its rounded pads in the earth. He found that if the herd was allowed to settle into that swinging gait between a trot and a canter, then they could keep it up for a day and a night without pause. Whereas if they were taken in the full heat of noon, he could run them hard for the first 5 miles, winding them, bringing the tiny calves to a standstill so the cows stopped with them, flapping their huge ears to fan themselves, thrusting their trunk down their own throat to suck the water out of their belly and spray it over their head and neck. He learned to find the heart and the brain, the lungs and the spine hidden in that amorphous mountain of grey hide and flesh. He learned to break the shoulder when the beast stood broadside, dropping him as though he had been struck by lightning, or to take the hip shot as he ran choking in the dust cloud behind the herd, shattering the hip joint and pinning the beast for an unhurried coup de grace. He hunted the herds on the hilltops, where they had climbed to catch the soothing evening breeze. At dawn he hunted in the thick forests and the open glades, and at noon he hunted them in the old overgrown gardens of a vanished people. For the land that he had first believed devoid of human presence was not, and had never been so, for unnumbered thousands of years. Beyond the abandoned gardens where once man had planted his crops, but where now the elephant herds had returned to reclaim their heritage, Zuga found the remains of huge native cities, the long-deserted keystones of a once-flourishing civilization, though all that remained were the circular outlines of the thatch and daub huts on the bare earth, the blackened hearthstones and the charred fence-poles of the cattle enclosures, which must once have penned great herds. Judging by the height of the secondary growth in the ancient gardens, no man had farmed here for many decades. It seemed strange to find these great grey herds of elephant ranging slowly through the ruined towns and fields. Zuga was reminded of a line from that strange exotic poetry that had been published in London the previous year, and which he had read just before sailing. They say the lion and the lizard keep the courts where Jamshid gloried and drank deep, and Bahram, that great hunter, the wild ass stamps o'er his head, and he lies fast asleep. Zuga scratched amongst foundations of the huts, and found the deep ash, which must once have been the wooden walls and thatched roofs. In one ancient village, Zuga counted 1,000 such dwellings before giving up the count. A numerous people. But where had they gone? He found a partial answer in an ancient battlefield on the open ground beyond the 1,000 huts. The bones were white as daisies in the sunlight, bleached and dried out, most of them half buried in the rich red soil, or covered by the dense fields of waving, fluffy-topped grass. The human remains covered an area of many acres, and they lay in clumps and chains like newly cut wheat, awaiting the reavers. Nearly every one of the skulls had been crushed in, as if by a fierce blow with a club or mace. Zuga realized that it was not so much a battlefield as a killing ground. For such slaughter could not be called warfare. If this toll had been repeated at each of the ruined towns he had stumbled upon, then the final total of the dead must have been in the tens or even hundreds of thousands. It was small wonder that what human presence remained was in tiny scattered groups like the handful of warriors that had tried to prevent them crossing the pass of the elephant road.